KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Good morning. Former President Biden has cancer. His office says it metastasized, but that it still can be managed. We bring in a doctor to analyze what that diagnosis means in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Years after leaving the European Union, the UK decides it may need Europe after all. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The British won't try to undo Brexit, but they are attending their first summit with the EU since the breakup. Also, a man in the wreckage of Gaza calls to give the perspective from his tent. And Leo XIV gives the perspective of a new pope. It's Monday, May 19th. This day in 1962, the film star Marilyn Monroe appeared at a Democratic fundraiser and sang Happy Birthday to President John F. Kennedy. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is expected to hold a phone call next hour with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump says he's still hoping to end Russia's war in Ukraine. NPR's Charles Maines reports Trump will also speak with leaders from Ukraine and NATO.
The phone calls come in the wake of peace talks between Russian and Ukrainian delegations in Istanbul, Turkey on Friday, their first direct negotiations since the early days of the war. That led to an agreement for a mass prisoner swap, but fell short of Western demands Russia join Ukraine in signing on to an immediate 30-day ceasefire. Instead, Russia has kept up the military pressure, launching mass drone attacks over the weekend. Charles Maines, NPR News. Moscow.
Powerful storms that raked the central U.S. over the weekend have killed at least 28 people. At least 19 victims are in Kentucky. From member station WEKU, Stan Ingold reports the Federal Emergency Management Agency is expected to start assessing Kentucky damage today.
Over the weekend, Governor Andy Beshear said he had put in a request for a federal disaster declaration, a process that he noted has become familiar.
I've now been governor for at least 14 federally declared disasters, 13 of them weather, and this is one of the worst. It's one of the worst in terms of the loss of human life. It's one of the worst in terms of damage, and it's tough.
This is the third major natural disaster to hit Kentucky this year, with two rounds of heavy flooding happening in April and in February. For NPR News, I'm Stan Ingold in Richmond, Kentucky.
The storms also killed several people in Missouri. On Friday, a tornado left 8 miles of damage outside St. Louis. Officials say thousands of buildings were damaged, causing at least $1 billion in damage. Last night, tornado warnings were issued in Kansas, where there are now reports of extensive damage to several buildings in the western part of the state. The cryptocurrency exchange Coinbase is set to join the S&P 500 when trading opens later this hour. NPR's Rafael Nam reports it's the first crypto company to become part of this major stock index.
Just over 2 years ago, crypto exchange FTX collapsed. Today, a different exchange, Coinbase, is set to join the ranks of 500 of the biggest public companies in the U.S. Here's Faryar Shirzad, Coinbase Chief Policy Officer.
I think it's a historic moment for the industry, and it's a really special moment for Coinbase.
And that's in part because things have changed under President Trump. His administration is taking a far friendlier approach to the crypto industry. Trump himself has a financial stake in the crypto sector, raising major concerns about conflicts of interest. All of this is alarming consumer advocates who warn this is a nascent industry rife with potential for fraud and shady characters.
NPR's Rafael Nam. This is NPR. Republicans have voted to advance a multi-trillion-dollar budget package out of committee and to the full House for a vote. Democrats vehemently oppose it. They say the package will deeply cut social services Americans need and instead fund tax cuts for wealthy people. Former President Joe Biden has been diagnosed with prostate cancer, according to his office. The cancer has spread to the bone. Biden's office says he was checked after developing symptoms, and it says the cancer appears to be hormone sensitive. This means there are options for effective disease management. Many consumers look to purchase homes during the spring, and this season there are new rules around how agents are paid. It follows a settlement last year with the National Association of Realtors. NPR's Laurel Walmsley has more on flat fee payments.
For a long time, buying and selling a home was pretty straightforward. The seller paid a commission to both the buyer's and seller's agent, totaling 5 to 6% of the sales price. For Jim Shao, a home buyer in Georgia, it was just too much money going to the realtors.
When you try to negotiate, you basically just told, nope, that's our rate.
But following the realtor's settlement, agents must now tell their prospective clients that their rates are fully negotiable. So Shao found an agent who agreed to a flat fee to help him buy a new home. And he got $14,000 back to put toward the closing. Despite the new rules, commissions for buyer's agents overall have barely budged. Shao says consumers just need the confidence to ask for options beyond the status quo. Laurel Walmsley, NPR News.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, what does an election in Romania tell us about the political direction of Europe?
First, though, former President Biden has been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and it has spread to his bones.
The news from his office comes as new attention is focused on the president's decline while in office.
We're joined now by NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith to discuss. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning.
So, Tam, what do you know about the diagnosis?
According to a statement from Biden's personal office, the cancer was detected after he experienced increasing urinary symptoms, and it has metastasized to his bones and is a more aggressive form of prostate cancer. The statement says it appears to be hormone sensitive, which means there are options for effective management, and the former president and his family are reviewing treatment options with his physicians. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in elderly men, and Biden is 82 years old. He was the oldest president in U.S. history. And there has been this intense focus on his health for years now, but especially after the disastrous debate performance less than a year ago, that performance that ultimately led to him dropping out of the race for president.
And I want to talk more about that. But before we get to that, I mean, reactions have been pouring in to this diagnosis or the news of this diagnosis. Any of them stand out to you?
You know, President Trump, who spends a lot of time trashing Biden, was quite gracious, writing on social media that he and the First Lady were saddened to hear about his diagnosis and wished Biden a fast and successful recovery. Former Vice President Kamala Harris posted, quote, "I know he will face this challenge with the same strength, resilience, and optimism that have always defined his life and leadership."
Now, Tam, you talked about his decline while in office and the focus of that. And this is all happening in a week where there was already going to be a focus on the former president because of the release of a book about his health while in office, right?
Yeah, the book is called Original Sin, written by CNN's Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson from Axios, and it alleges that Biden experienced both a physical and cognitive decline while in office, and that those closest to him covered it up. In an interview with NPR's Scott Detrow that will air on All Things Considered later today, Tapper said everyone loses their train of thought or forgets a name from time to time, but this was different.
We're talking about to the point of you are not able to have a conversation. You are not able to come up with data, information, knowledge, names that you should have at the ready.
Including not recognizing George Clooney at a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. Biden on The View said the authors are wrong and there is nothing to sustain their claims.
Now, the claims in this book, are there broader implications here about Biden's fitness while in office?
Oh, this is likely to be an extended and uncomfortable news cycle for Democrats who are trying to move on and restore trust with voters. Mm-hmm. Voters who made it clear they thought Biden was too old to run for re-election well before the Democratic establishment acknowledged it. But the midterm elections are more than 18 months away. The economy and President Trump's leadership are almost certainly going to be bigger issues than Joe Biden, who is already in the rearview mirror. And in a week where Republicans are trying to advance Trump's one big beautiful bill, which includes both tax cuts and spending cuts, Democratic politicians would much rather be talking about what's in that bill than rehashing the political tragedy of Joe Biden.
NPR's Tamara Key, thank you for joining us, Tam.
You're welcome.
Dr. Ben Davies has been reading the statement of the former president. He's a professor of urology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and is here with some analysis. Good morning.
Good morning.
The one thing that I know about prostate cancer as a layman is that most men, nearly all men, are said to survive it. It's not supposed to be that bad. But in this case, we hear of something called a Gleason score of 9 and metastasis to the bone, which sounds very bad. So what do these things mean in layman's terms?
Yes, Steve. I wish I could disabuse you of some of those notions. Prostate cancer kills over 40,000 people a year in America. Of course, many men do not die from it. Actually, the majority do not die from it. In the president's case, he has a very bad version of it, probably the worst version you can get, and it has gone to his bones. Obviously, I don't know the extent of the disease, but there are some good options for him. And that could include hormonal injections, which should kind of calm it down and take away some of the testosterone levels in his body so the disease stops growing quite as fast and can kind of almost melt away from the bones. He also can get chemotherapy, which is a great study that happened just a few years ago, which could extend his life if he qualifies for it. And radiation therapy, too, is definitely in play, which also has been proven to extend life in patients with newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer. So he's got quite a lot of things he could do. I think frailty is an issue for him because some of the medicines can increase some of the frailty aspects of life. But it's not all doom and gloom, to be honest. He can easily live 10 years with this disease. In fact, I think about the median life is about 5 to 7 years from newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer. But he could easily go over that.
You mentioned frailty being an issue here. Are your options limited somewhat when you're 82?
No, I don't think so. There's lots of different 82s. I've met marathoners, you know, who are 82-year-old. So it's not really an age-specific thing. It's more the, you know, physiology and how he can take the therapies that he's getting.
Are you surprised at all that we would learn about this quite suddenly from a single screening and that it's an advanced case that we presume, from what we know, was not noticed or caught earlier?
Oh, boy, it's a little bit of an intellectual question, I think, Steve. You know, it's a humble business being a physician, and, you know, even if you screen regularly, many patients, you know, we can't find the disease before it's already in your bones. You can't screen away, you know, prostate cancer. It's going to happen to every physician. So I wasn't that surprised, to be honest with you.
So if someone asked questions, and of course questions are already being asked about the president's health while he was president, if someone raised the question of whether there should have been something said or noticed about this while he was president, you would not say there automatically should have been?
No, I think that would be ridiculous. No.
So what resources would you recommend for people who are in the former president's position, who are asking questions about their own health?
Sure. I think, you know, if you're an 80-year-old man and you're wondering whether or not you have prostate cancer, obviously you should see your primary care physician and go over, you know, what it means to be screened. We do not, as a profession, screen men in their 80s for prostate cancer for a variety of reasons, most of which you've mentioned, because most prostate cancers found in that age are indolent. So if you screened a population of patients for prostate cancer in their 80s, you would be getting all kinds of diseases you didn't need to know about and adding unwarranted worry to those patients. So I would talk to your primary care physician about what it means to be screened, the pluses and the minuses. And I would actually recommend not to screen most 80-year-old men.
Really? So what is the age where you should be getting screened?
There's actually a few definitions, but between 50 and 70 are the current recommendations for most organizations.
And you said something at the beginning. You said 40,000 people die of prostate cancer, and yet the common wisdom that came to me was that it's easily treatable, that you can do something about this, and most people are fine. Why is it that 40,000 people are still dying if there are so many treatments available?
Oh, well, you're asking me a tricky question, but I mean, obviously people get cancer all the time and pass away from it. So it's not uncommon with prostate cancer to pass away with it. I think I'd like to emphasize a few things, Steve, if you'll let me.
Yeah.
We've had made major gains in prostate cancer care in the metastatic space over the past 10 years and really extended life. So there's no reason to think that the president can't really have an extended life with metastatic prostate cancer. 10 years is not unheard of with disease in your bones. We will only make headway into prostate cancer care with careful and robust funding of our science institutions, which I'm really hoping will continue. And that will pave the way for the future people who get the disease the president has.
This is something that the president himself advocated for. Dr. Ben Davies, professor of urology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Thanks for your insights. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
The centrist pro-European mayor of Bucharest was elected president of Romania yesterday, beating a right-wing Eurosceptic. NPR's Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz reports that the contest was seen as a litmus test over whether populist nationalism or Western democracy would prevail.
With nearly all the ballots counted, preliminary official results show 54% of Romanian voters choosing Bucharest Mayor Nicu Șordan as their president. His opponent was Georgia Simion, a nationalist and admirer of President Donald Trump. And while he received just 46% of the vote, Simion claimed victory and called for national protests, railing against what he said was an attempt to, quote, steal the victory of the Romanian people.
But I think the safety of the large difference made that impossible.
Clara Volintiru is regional director of the Black Sea Trust for Regional Cooperation, a project of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, a public policy think tank.
Even if Nicu Șordan would have won, but would have won by a small margin, then social unrest would have followed today.
Volintiru says Dan's result of just 20% of the vote in the first round of the election to become today's winner was an amazing comeback by the centrist independent politician. But his victory will likely anger many right-wing politicians abroad, including J.D. Vance. He criticized a Romanian court's decision last year to annul the first round of this presidential election after state intelligence revealed that Russia interfered in the election, a claim Moscow denies. Volintiru says this second round's margin of victory, though, is enough to quiet these critics.
The fact that there was a big difference, a clear win, has really reestablished the faith in the democratic process in Romania, both domestically and abroad.
She says it'll also calm fears in Europe that the democratic backsliding seen in parts of Central and Eastern Europe is not happening in Romania, a country that borders Ukraine and plays a key role in defending NATO's eastern flank against Russia. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR News.
The Broadway play Oh Mary is a crazy comic reimagining of First Lady Mary Todd Lincoln in the days leading up to her husband's assassination. The New York Times calls it one of the best comedies in years, and it's received Tony nominations, including Best Play and Best Leading Actor. On the next Fresh Air, writer and star Cola Scola. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Total Wine & More for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Israel's military has begun extensive ground operations throughout Gaza. At the same time, Israelis say they will allow in some food, just as a United Nations-backed group raised the odds of famine. The many perspectives we're hearing include Yusri Al-Ghul. We called him late last week and reached him on a scratchy phone line. He was in North Gaza, where he lives with his wife and four children. Yusri. It's Steve Inskeep.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Hi. Doing okay. Thank you for taking the time to talk today. I really appreciate it.
I'm just closing the windows of my tent, so just to be available to talk to you.
Did you say closing the windows of your tent?
Yes, I did.
He says he's a writer. Years ago, he worked for the Gaza Ministry of Culture. He says he doesn't support Hamas today and favors releasing hostages while also repeatedly accusing Israel of genocide, a charge Israelis deny. We asked him to describe daily life, and as you will hear, the conversation took a turn.
Yeah, I'm in the north of Gaza. I didn't leave it. I have two houses. They were severely demolished, so I put my tent in the rubble of my house.
So you were on the location of your former home, surrounded by rubble?
Yes.
How are you feeding yourself and your family at this time?
My friend, we are in a famine. We just have some bread. And that's it. And even the bread. I'm always telling my children, please don't eat all of this bread. This is for the morning, and that is for the evening. And that's it. We don't find water. We don't find electricity. We don't find internet. They're saying that they want to evacuate us. Please come and take us out of Gaza. We want to leave it. We want to leave Gaza because you destroyed everything.
Did you just say if you had an offer to go live somewhere else, you would take it?
Sure. Not only me. 90% of the Palestinians. We don't have anything here in the Gaza Strip to stay. We don't have water. We don't have food. We just have bloodshed. Then you ask me, will you stay here? No, I want to leave it.
What is your feeling right now about Hamas?
Sure. Listen to me, my friend. If you ask me about what happened of the 7th of October and blah, 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 what happened before 6th of October? What happened in the West Bank, which is the Hamas, not a part of the government in the West Bank? The Israelis always killing the Palestinians, even in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank.
I want to assure you that I've covered that region for years, that I've been to the West Bank and Gaza. I understand the argument that you're making, your side of the story about the history. I'm just interested now in this moment, what your attitude is toward Hamas, which would seem to be the strongest Palestinian force in Gaza.
There was no Hamas here, my friend. Just to let you know, the Israeli killed all of them. They destroyed the whole buildings of Hamas. They destroyed even the buildings of the civilians. So my viewpoint about Hamas is like my viewpoint about the radical government, Israeli government. They both are terrorists. I do believe that we need to integrate in a diverse world. We need to be in touch. We need to build a two-state solution, which is refused by the Israeli government.
You mentioned that the only thing you've had to eat lately is bread. Where do you get it? Where does it come from?
In the time of truce, before 2 months, they opened the borders for just 50 days, I think. When they brought the food and the aid, in this time. I tried to bring it and to buy and to hide it because I believe the Israeli also will come again and to make this a starvation and to fight us in a famine in the Gaza Strip. You know that we have a dream. I'm always telling my wife that I wish I could have a plate of salad. I wish I could see tomato with cucumber and with other kind. And even the melon, we don't have it. Just imagine, you don't have these things.
And because you said you would be willing to leave Gaza if someone would just let you leave, you, I presume, have heard that President Trump talked about removing the Gaza population and rebuilding Gaza as a seaside resort and finding someplace else for Palestinians to live. What do you think about that idea?
Listen to me, my friend. I think, I'm sorry to say that. I know that I'm talking to American people. But this is a lunatic idea. I'm not going to talk about the man. I'm talking about, I do respect the power of Mr. Trump. I don't mind to leave Gaza, but not to Egypt or to Jordan. I wish I could have the opportunity to go to Canada and to go to the United States. We are just 2 million. We are not a very crowded number of Palestinians.
If you could come to the United States, you would give up Gaza. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I wish I could come to the United States with my family. I wish I could have.
Yusriel Gul, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
He spoke last week in Gaza before Israeli forces escalated operations.
Tens of thousands of people filled St. Peter's Square in Vatican City to witness the inaugural Mass of Pope Leo XIV. Leo is the first American to lead the Catholic Church. He promised to protect the Catholic tradition, and in a gesture of humility, he said, "I was chosen without any merit of my own."
Sono stato scelto senza alcun merito, e con timore e tremore vengo a voi come un fratello.
Speaking in Italian, Leo added, "I come to you as a brother who wants to be a servant." He spoke of a world reconciled.
Che diventi fermento per un mondo riconciliato.
Having said that, Leo was like his predecessor, Pope Francis, in offering strong views on divisive issues. Leo criticized a world economic system that exploits the Earth's resources and sidelines the poorest.
Che sfrutta le risorse della terra ed emargina i più poveri.
Our correspondent Ruth Sherlock heard a few of the responses from the crowd at St. Peter's, among them Joel McMichael, who's a seminarian from Texas.
I'm hopeful for he's wanting to address issues of media and AI and these kind of things. He seems that's an important thing.
Francesca Montarulli from southern Italy took issue with his remarks on marriage.
La cosa che a me non è piaciuta.
She says, "I didn't like that he says that the family is made up of a mother and a father." Montarulli says she believes God loves everyone regardless of who they are.
Another person in the crowd was Melissa Hale of Georgia.
We are very hopeful that Pope Leo will be able to take the church forward into the future.
She says she's excited about his calls for peace. This is NPR News.
In their new book, Original Sin, journalists Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson chronicle what they say is Joe Biden's cognitive decline during his presidency and efforts to hide that decline.
Having a former member of the cabinet say that they didn't have confidence that he could be commander-in-chief at a moment of crisis, that was a moment that made me pause.
Hear more on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is scheduled to speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during separate phone calls today. The leaders are expected to discuss an ongoing diplomatic push to end the war in Ukraine. The Prime Minister of Israel is allowing some aid into Gaza after a nearly three-month blockade. Israel has launched an extensive ground offensive in Gaza in an effort to force Hamas to surrender and release the remaining Israeli hostages. NPR's Kerry Khan reports from Tel Aviv.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will allow a, quote, basic quantity of food into Gaza and control all aid distribution there. He also said Israel will hold on to territory seized by ground forces in what he says will be a plan to, quote, taking control of all of Gaza. Intense shelling and airstrikes in northern Gaza has forced Palestinians to flee like 50-year-old Wael al-Kilani, who walked for hours with his wife and seven children. He says the bombing was intense, with planes striking, artillery fire, and tanks. Hamas and Israel are currently holding indirect talks in Doha. Israel demands Hamas lay down its arms. Hamas wants international guarantees for a negotiated end to the war. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News. Telecommunications company Verizon is the latest big company to scale back on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts under pressure from the federal government. NPR's Maria Aspen reports the Federal Communications Commission gave Verizon its blessing on Friday for a $20 billion deal.
Many big companies are backing away from what's known as DEI after once promising to create more equitable opportunities for all employees. But now, President Trump has declared such programs illegal, and the Federal Communications Commission has taken a big role in trying to pressure companies to do away with them. For example, Verizon has been seeking approval to buy Frontier, a broadband provider. So it told the FCC that it would end many of its policies relating to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Verizon will no longer set goals to hire more minorities, and it will remove references to DEI from its websites. Now the FCC has approved Verizon's deal, and it specifically cited Verizon's promise to end DEI-related practices. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
A statewide rail strike in New Jersey has come to an end. Union leaders and New Jersey Transit reached a tentative agreement that includes wage increases, improved safety measures, and revised scheduling protocols. Trains are expected to resume full service by Tuesday morning. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The United Kingdom is living in the aftermath of all those slogans about leaving the European Union.
Let's get Brexit done.
Brexit means Brexit.
Now, I voted for Brexit. I believe in Brexit.
That was Boris Johnson, Theresa May, and Rishi Sunak, prime ministers who presided over stages of Britain's exit from the European Union. Now, 5 years after Brexit took effect, Britain wants closer ties with the EU. Today, they held their first formal summit since the breakup and announced new deals on defense, food safety, and border checks. NPR's Lauren Freyer is covering this. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Steve.
What's the news here?
So they've announced new cooperation on defense, energy, agriculture, and food safety, measures to ease border checks. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer actually voted against Brexit back in that 2016 vote. He's in favor of closer ties, and so he's making good on that today. Here he is at a news conference.
Ladies and gentlemen, Britain is back on the world stage, working with our partners, doing deals that will grow our economy.
Starmer says these deals will slash red tape, help the British economy grow. It shrank, as you'll recall, after Brexit. Yeah. But he's already facing some domestic criticism from opposition politicians who call this summit a surrender and a Brexit betrayal. They accuse him of selling out to the EU with deals like one announced today that extends Europeans' right to fish in British waters for another 12 more years.
Well, this is backing up a little bit, although I guess it's short of actually trying to undo Brexit, right?
Exactly. So polls show a majority of Britons do think Brexit was a mistake. Tabloids here call it regret or regrexit.
Okay.
But nobody really has the appetite to reverse all of those negotiations and undo Brexit. So what Starmer says he's doing is a reset with the EU, not a reversal. I spoke to Jill Rudder, a former top civil servant who worked on Brexit, and she says, you know, it's kind of like a couple that broke up but still have to share custody of the kids.
So it wasn't just like splitting up the record collection. It's a bit more like you agreed a deal on custody of the kids for 5 years, but then said we'll come back to it and sort it out longer term.
Britain and the EU already have tariff-free trade, but today they announced more cooperation on things like food safety, carbon emissions, allowing Brits to use the e-gates at European airports. There are also topics, though, that were off the table today.
Such as what?
Such as Britain will remain outside the EU's single market. It will continue to sign its own trade deals. You'll recall one recently that the UK struck with the Trump administration for relief of some US tariffs. A red line for the UK is also freedom of movement. EU citizens still will not be able to come and live and work freely in Britain and vice versa. Many people who voted for Brexit did so to limit immigration, and they still want to do that. But today they carved out some exceptions. So for example, British students and 20-somethings will be able to work short-term jobs in Europe and vice versa. And perhaps the biggest cooperation will be on defense and security, which is really relevant to Ukraine.
Which has got to be the elephant in the room here.
Two elephants in the room, kind of. Ukraine, but also President Trump. You know, Britain and the EU are already bolstering Ukraine's defense, spending more of their on their own defense amid Trump's calls for NATO members to share the burden. And so under the deal announced today, Britain will be able to access EU defense loans worth $170 billion.
And Pierce Lauren Freire, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Law enforcement in Southern California say they're fairly confident they know who's responsible for a large car bomb that badly damaged a fertility clinic in Palm Springs over the weekend. They're calling the incident, which killed one person and wounded four others, an act of terrorism. NPR's Jason DeRose reports from Palm Springs.
The FBI says 25-year-old Guy Edward Bartkus is the primary suspect in the bombing of the American Reproductive Center's clinic on Saturday morning, and they say he tried to live stream the attack. Akil Davis is the assistant director of the Bureau's Los Angeles office, and he says the suspect may have held the extremist view that people should not procreate.
The subject had nihilistic ideations, and this was a targeted attack against the IVF facility. Make no mistake, we are treating this as an intentional act of terrorism.
The explosion was powerful. It collapsed part of the clinic's one-story stucco and tile building and shattered windows blocks around. Davis says debris is strewn across the five-lane street on which the clinic is located and that it's probably one of the biggest bomb explosions in Southern California history.
Just for reference, to throw pieces of vehicle hundreds of feet in the air and then several blocks away, imagine how big that bomb device was.
This resort town of about 45,000 residents lies in the desert roughly 2 hours east of Los Angeles, and it's shaken. The city's police chief, Andrew Mills, wants to reassure residents and visitors.
This is a city of people celebrating. Life is a beacon and a safe haven for all. And we really focus on inclusivity and a community that is welcoming to all people.
Mills is referring to the city's large LGBTQ population. In fact, the IVF clinic that was attacked specifically caters to members of the community seeking to have children. He says that because of the swift action of the Palm Springs Fire Department, all the embryos stored at the clinic were saved.
I really want to recognize the IVF community. This has been one of those heartbreaking things for many community members who are going through the process of trying to build families.
A person who wanted to instill fear in our community with an act of terrorism may have caused damage to our buildings, but that person only managed to unite our community even more.
The city's mayor pro tem, Naomi Soto, wants to pull focus back to Palm Springs' strength.
We stand united against violence, against hate. Palm Springs is a city of love, acceptance, joy, and hope.
About an hour northeast of Palm Springs, on the other side of Joshua Tree National Park, is the city of 29 Palms. That's where authorities believe suspect Guy Edward Bartkus may have lived. Over the weekend, they evacuated a neighborhood there due to fears of additional explosives in a house possibly owned by the suspect's mother. 29 Palms resident Thomas Bickle lives near that site.
I just got done talking to my kids on the phone. Like, all of a sudden, it wasn't just a knock. The sheriffs were pounding on my door. So I opened the door. There was about, I think, like five sheriffs there, and they told me I needed to evacuate.
Bickle says the evacuation came as a shock.
About 20 years ago, I was in Afghanistan. And when I came back, the last thing I thought I'd have to worry about here is bombs, let alone right by my house.
Authorities say the four people wounded in the attack have been treated and released. The FBI continues to investigate the motive behind the bombing, but because they believe the suspect is the lone person who died in the explosion, the FBI says the community is no longer in danger from him. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Palm Springs, California.
This is NPR News.
Scott Tong. Key minerals make batteries, weapons, and medical technologies. A lot live on the ocean floor, which has never been commercially mined. President Trump wants to change that. But what's the environmental risk?
We're not going to learn those things until we start exploring and extracting. You can't model this stuff. You have to measure it.
Next time, here and now.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Contractors in Central Florida conducted a routine inspection of a stormwater pipe. They sent a robotic camera looking for cracks, which instead found an alligator, 5 feet long, relaxing in the water. The city posted the video, and now the alligator has a fan base who gave it a nickname, the Pipe Puppy. Officials don't seem bothered. Alligators can easily get in and out of storm drains, so he can leave when he's ready, and nobody's going to make him. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's the latest change for cryptocurrency under President Trump. A crypto exchange becomes listed as one of the big companies that are used to track the broader economy. People follow different indices of stocks. The Dow tracks 30 industrial companies, for example. The S&P 500 is a broader index of big companies, and the S&P 500 now includes a crypto firm for the first time. NPR senior business editor Rafael Nam is covering this. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How did we get to this?
Well, I really don't think it's an exaggeration to say that for the crypto sector, everything changed when Trump became president again. Now, keep in mind, for years, crypto was this weird and fringe investment. But now a radical change is taking place. Crypto is going legit. Coinbase joining the S&P is the latest sign of that. They are a big exchange for trading all kinds of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Here's Brian Armstrong, the CEO of Coinbase, in an interview with Yahoo Finance.
Coinbase joining the S&P 500 means crypto's here to stay. It's going to be in everybody's 401k. Everyone's going to have crypto exposure, you know, at least indirectly through Coinbase.
And a big part of why this is happening is President Trump.
If people buy a mutual fund, if they buy a stock index fund, it may be based on the S&P 500, and they're effectively buying Coinbase, although not directly. So why is it that Trump has been able to drive this change?
Because he's embraced crypto in a way that's unprecedented. He even stands to gain from it. Early this year, he launched his own meme coin called Simply Trump.
Right.
And these are cryptocurrencies that are associated with internet memes, essentially things that are trending. And this Wednesday, he's invited over 200 of the top buyers of his meme coin for a dinner. Now, that's raising concerns that investors from all around the world who have bought this cryptocurrency could find a way to influence the president. The White House has been denying this, saying these are private ventures, but President Trump's own sons are also deeply involved in crypto ventures. It's another way people think companies and countries could try to influence the president.
Is the administration also changing regulation of this industry in which the president is personally involved along with his family?
Yes, in a very substantial way, Steve. I'm talking specifically about the Securities and Exchange Commission. This is the federal agency that's effectively the top cop for Wall Street. And under President Biden, the SEC took a very tough approach to crypto. About 2 years ago, the agency even sued Coinbase for not following the same rules that every Wall Street firm does. But under this administration, they have dropped the lawsuit and are taking a much less aggressive stance.
Who, if anybody, is raising concerns here?
Well, consumer advocates are certainly alarmed because crypto has this incredible history of volatility, right? A history of big gains, yeah, but also big crashes. And this is a sector sort of infamous for being used in all kinds of fraud and illegal activities. So just over 2 years ago, another crypto exchange, FTX, collapsed, if you remember. But now Coinbase is joining the S&P. And in the scope of literally just months, we've gone from the U.S. government saying, hey, this could be dangerous for average Americans who might be buying into something they don't really understand, to President Trump declaring that the U.S. should be the crypto capital of the planet.
NPR's Rafael Nam is the capital of crypto correspondence. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. 400 years old. That's the age of the oldest bonsai tree in North America. Its birthday was celebrated this month, and NPR's Destiny Adams was there.
On a recent sunny morning at the National Bonsai and Panjin Museum at the National Arboretum, a crowd of visitors are taking turns admiring the peace tree.
A literal translation of bonsai is a tree in a pot, or a plant in a pot, or a tree in a tray, if you like alliteration.
That's Aaron Stratton. The former president of the American Bonsai Society sports a large straw hat and a wide, contagious grin as he gestures toward the Yumaki pine, about 2 feet tall in a black rectangular pot, its green foliage perfectly trimmed.
It is the tree in this national collection that has been cared for as a bonsai for the longest amount of time, been in a pot, taken care of by people for 400 years. And that's an amazing thing.
This tree has survived a lot. It was first potted in Hiroshima, Japan, 400 years ago by the Yamaki family, a family known for operating a commercial bonsai nursery in the city for several generations. The bonsai survived the U.S. bombing of the city in 1945. Here's a video from the U.S. War Department describing the scene.
The bomb was exploded above the city, and in the towering mushroom, Japan could read its doom.
Over 30 years later, Japan gifted 53 bonsai trees, including this one, to the United States as a sort of peace offering for its bicentennial. Michael James is the curator of the museum, and he calls bonsai an art form.
That is a multi-generational art. So it's passed down, it's passed forward to others. That's how it brings people together.
Guy Guidry is a bonsai artist from New Orleans, Louisiana, and he has a tree on display.
Could you take us over to it?
It'd be a pleasure.
In American flag boots, he marches over to his tree, which stands out among the rest. It has no leaves, and it is meticulously wrapped in a jet black wire. Guidry says he adopted his first bonsai 30 years ago from a neighbor who had neglected the plant.
Growing bonsai is just like growing a dog or a cat or having a child. It's something you can't neglect.
Guidry laughs as he reminisces about all the friends and bonsai mentors he's met in the past 3 decades. He is a proud embodiment of what this anniversary represents: togetherness, friendship, and peace. Destiny Adams, NPR News.
If you're trying to build up muscle, you need protein. So does it matter if that protein comes from meat or from plants? NPR's Will Stone flexes some reporting muscle on the evidence.
It was a long-held belief that making gains in the gym requires meat. This wasn't a matter of bro science. Nicholas Bird says this is what the well-controlled studies were finding.
It was certainly ingrained in my mind that animal's better than plant, right?
Bird researches exercise and nutrition at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. The issue here is protein quality. Amino acids are the building blocks of our muscles, and meat has an abundance of the ones we need to grow them.
It should make sense. If you're eating meat, you're eating basically muscle, right? So that protein mirrors our skeletal muscle in terms of its amino acid composition.
Plant proteins also have the essential amino acids, but some are in lower concentrations.
They're lower quality when you view a single plant-based meal versus an animal-based meal.
But does this mean you can't build muscle as well on plant protein? Actually, no. The evidence for this has been growing in recent years. Some of the latest data comes from Bird's lab. He followed healthy young adults over 9 days and 3 weightlifting sessions. Everyone ate the same amount of protein, but some were vegan, others omnivores. Here's what they found when they analyzed the muscle tissue at the end of the study.
The muscle building potential, and likely, based on our data, the long-term muscle mass gains would be the same.
It's not that earlier research was wrong. Benjamin Wall at the University of Exeter says it just didn't give the full picture.
One of the main reasons why people assumed an inferiority of plant versus animal proteins was the studies that were a single meal, a single protein, over a few hours.
But the story changed with longer studies that mixed up the sources of plant protein.
We now have several studies which suggest there's far less difference.
So long as people are mindful about what they eat. For example, peas are a good source of the amino acid leucine, which is critical for switching on protein synthesis, but it's low in methionine, so you can look for that somewhere else, like in rice. These studies make it easy. They give the participants well-balanced meals.
What they don't do is address the real-world challenge that it is probably harder to consume higher protein diets and you have fewer choices as a vegan.
And meat is more protein dense, so you can end up eating more calories to get the same amount from plants. Exactly how much is enough protein is another, sometimes divisive question. This depends on your activity level, your goals, your age. The University of Illinois study focused on building muscle. People ate 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. That's 50% more than what U.S. guidelines recommend, but pretty representative of how Americans are eating. James McKendry at the University of British Columbia says it's a reasonable target. You can bump that up to as high as 1.6 grams.
Really looking to squeeze out the maximum amount of protein, and beyond that point, there's really diminishing returns.
And McKendry says, remember, protein, wherever you get it from, is just one ingredient in the muscle-building equation.
Protein is really the icing on the cake for building muscle. And doesn't matter how much you consume, if you're not progressively resistance training, you're not going to build much muscle at all.
Here, research is very clear. Longevity, cardiovascular health, brain function, all of this improves when you challenge your muscles and pick up some weights. Will Stone, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at BetterHelp.com/public.
Don't know about you, Layla, but I'm going to have to get out and exercise a little bit.
Maybe.
Maybe. But not you. You'll be exercising sometime.
Me, yeah. Sometimes. You're maybe
fit.
One day.
You're fit. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin.